Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel. NFL Week 5, Monday Night Football Edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Gotta tell you, these Monday morning podcasts are a little more difficult after a bad weekend.
Yeah, it's never ideal. You feel you get a little more pep in your step, and you're a little more anxious and excited to discuss the weekend that was when you have a winner in your back pocket. But alas, unfortunately, that hasn't quite been the case.
Not at all. And starting to get the sniffles. The lack of sleep is kicking in. So I just this morning ordered a five count of Zicam. So we got that rolling in, and we're off.
Figured you kept that in supply. I mean, you probably had a 360 days worth supply of it, but no, you had to actually order some fresh supplies for the upcoming football season.
I've already gone through five packs in the first 5 weeks, so excuse me, that's that's where we're at right now. You got to just pop them just anytime you feel like you might get the sniffles, or you have a little bit of a headache, or you're not getting the proper rest. Got to pop them.
That may tell us more than we need to know, but as long as you're not taking Xanax and Valium, we're headed in the right direction.
No.
And Payne, regardless of how our weekend went, it still went better than one particular football coach, one that has a special place in our hearts.
Who's that?
The one, the only Dan Quinn down there in lovely Atlanta, who took his general manager, Thomas Dimitrov, to the employment line with him.
Yeah, that was smart, just clearing the entire deck there. Listen, you're never rooting for anyone to get fired.
No, of course not. That's
and
not our style.
And the obvious is, yeah, the obvious is that things weren't going well. But past the point of record, all the little things leading up to this made me feel like this was should have been done ages ago. Right? I mean, like Dan Quinn's fired himself multiple times already. Arthur Blank just hadn't. So that was pretty telling. All the players that have been drafted there defensively, none of them have materialized. So that's partly why Dimitrov is gone. But Dan Quinn hasn't been able to develop that talent, whether it was at pass rusher or in the secondary either. So it's not just about the results, which are very poor, and being a defensive-minded guy with a piss-poor defense that blows large leads, but the maturation of some of these players that have been drafted, Dan Quinn hasn't been able to get them to the level that most thought they would be able to play at. So it's a culmination of a lot of things. This was long overdue. This is the least shocking news ever. In fact, if he was still retained and able to coach moving forward, that would have been the bigger shocker here for Dan Quinn.
That now makes two coaches that have outlasted Adam Gase so far this season, which continues to be one of the more intriguing storylines out there. If you're the Atlanta Falcons, Payne, and you're looking to try and bring in someone, I mean, are you focusing on the offensive side, I'd have to imagine, and do you begin to look at other head coaches or coordinators in the NFL, or do you even decide to tap into the potential college pipelines?
You're definitely going offense. I always talk about this. This seems so simple to me right now. You can't hire a defensive-minded coach to be your head coach. I truly believe that. In 2020, the way the rules are designed, with offense meaning more and having more value than defense, you have to go with an offensive mind, not just from that perspective, but you think about the hiring process along the way. If you're a defensive-minded head coach, you're probably going to have to continually hire new offensive minds, if they're any good, within 1 to 3 seasons. So there's going to be that constant turnover. If you hire the right guy offensively, he's going to get picked off for a better job. Just the reality of the situation, especially even at the college level, that's more so. But even at the NFL level, if you have a very good offensive-minded coach, he's going to get picked off for a job. And so you're going to have to rehire. You're going to always have to be good hiring and finding the right guy. And then you're likely going to be changing systems every few seasons. That's the downside. If you hire a defensive-minded coach and it goes swimmingly, it goes really well, you're going to have to continually hire well.
No, it's a great point. And I think it's one that a lot of people probably don't think about. When you have the change in continuity, you obviously want your offense to remain the same. Defensive systems come and go, and probably much easier to replace smart minds on that side of the ball, which I think leads into a perfect segue. When you talk about a defensive-minded head coach that showed an aggressive tendency, and I really believe it was the right call, last night in Sunday Night Football, Mike Zimmer, torn apart by some of the idiots on social media, elected to go for it on 4th and inches. Ultimately, Seattle marches the length of the field. Russell Wilson leads his 30th game-winning touchdown drive. But there's no way to be critical of the Vikings trying to win it with their offense on the field. It's more a reflection of their inability to pick up 1 yard that would have ultimately led to victory.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's without question, to me, that was the right call. Now, I know a lot of the probability even suggested that it was a 50-50 coin flip in terms of win probability. But to me, at 1-3 and running for 6 yards a carry all night, picking up half a yard to end the game is the right situation there 100 out of 100 times. The problem is the things that preceded the decision were the weaknesses in the Achilles heel of the Vikings through the first month of the season. Now, those things through the first 58 minutes last night were fantastic. We talked about the O-line not being able to get a push all season. We talked about the defense throwing up on itself continually. And through 58 minutes, both of those things were the opposite. Defense was fantastic. Offensive line was awesome. But you just didn't get that final surge that you needed from the offensive line. And then defensively, you couldn't get the key stop. A crucial fourth down completions, two of them, both to DK Metcalf. And not going to lie, that was monstrous for us. It was good for our listeners. We went under 9 on the Vikings win total. So that was a big win to remove from the books of the Minnesota Vikings this season.
There is no doubt when you're a 7-point underdog and you have their win total under, you hope those are games they lose, even if they happen to be by the slimmest of margins. So Seattle goes into their bye week undefeated at 5-0. Minnesota continuing to take steps forward, but clearly one that they may regret. Knowing that the NFC playoff picture outside the top teams looks pretty muddled, and sitting at 2-3 would have been a lot better for them than 1-4. Right here, Payne, in my backyard, I think you have to tip your hat. The Raiders probably get their biggest win during the John Gruden era, going on the road to Arrowhead, winning outright as 13-point dogs on the open. We did see them take substantial steam on game day, with that number ultimately closing 10, even if it came at the expense of your beloved Patrick Mahomes.
Yes, that was one that was a little shocking. I didn't think they would get there outright, but anytime you can win one straight up as a touchdown or a double-digit dog there, you're probably going to make the good list. Derek Carr, I thought, was fantastic. The offense was, you know, efficient and explosive, and that's a pretty deadly combination. If you look, Vegas was able to play a little keep away because 63% of their runs graded successful. So they were able to maintain that possession, keep Mahomes on the sideline. Derek Carr hit a few big plays through the air. If you look, 10.8 yards per pass attempt, hit 6 explosives. And then the second half, you know, when you kind of consider the opponent, I think the Raiders defense played one of their better halves of football, probably in the Gruden era. You know, you hold Kansas City in that second half to a 21% success rate, 1.2 yards per carry. So you make the Chiefs one-dimensional in a game that was tied at one point. And then you look through the air, Casey and Mahomes, 28% success rate in the second half, and you force a turnover, get a couple big sacks there. So that is a monster win for the Raiders heading into their bye.
You know, midway through the fourth quarter, the Raiders defense had held the Chiefs just 25 yards. And then, of course, Kansas City finds ways to sustain drives late. And you start to wonder, is it going to happen? Is Patrick Mahomes going to show a little bit more magic? When they had dipped to as low as 15-1 moneyline underdogs chasing a 16-point deficit. But the Raiders, they get that monkey off their back, a huge win against Kansas City. And we know Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes have been damn near impossible to beat in that AFC West. In terms of other good performances or surprising in the positive manner, what stood out to you yesterday?
Obviously the Dolphins. you know, and I wasn't in love initially with the hiring of Old Man Chan, the Dolphins OC, but his game plan was good here against the 49ers. Now, it was an obvious game plan, right? But still good. You know, you have a gunslinger at quarterback that was almost benched this week going up against the San Francisco secondary. So Fitzpatrick really had nothing to lose, and he just came out attacking. The first play of the game was a deep shot to Preston Williams down the sideline. I thought that really set the tone. Fitzpatrick was actually the most accurate quarterback of week five to this point. Accuracy was 13% above expectation. He averaged over 11 yards per pass attempt and a 60% success rate with six explosives. So Fitzpatrick was awesome. The Dolphins offense was great, but I really like the aggressiveness there. And one thing Chan's done, while they've bogged down at times in the red zone because they've gone a little too run happy there, at least Chan is letting Fitzpatrick air it out. And I think those two receivers on the outside for the Dolphins are really, really underrated. So using those guys like a Preston Williams to go up against a beaten and battered 49ers secondary and Devontae Parker, they basically just dominated those guys outside. That was the right move, and Fitzpatrick was on fire.
Yeah, and to the Dolphins' credit, too, it looks like they found a running back that they can lean on a little bit more. We knew it was going to be a committee approach early on in the season, but Miles Gaskin has done everything in his power to kind of assert himself as the lead back there, and it's paying dividends. First score I saw in that game, 17-7 Miami. He had to do a double take, and then obviously it snowballed from there. Massive win for the Dolphins, who now have a very winnable football game on deck this coming weekend as they'll play host to the New York Jets with the schedule reshuffling that took place. For me, Payne, when I look
at an underdog story there, by the way, for Gaskins. Guy wasn't even projected to make the roster, and he's their starting running back.
You know, it seems that we get a lot more of these situations developing than we ever would have imagined. I mean, draft status doesn't appear to be the determining factor. I mean, Gaskins asserting himself there. We know about James Robinson has kind of taken on the leading role in Jacksonville, and albeit very different situations. Now, I know the Jags more or less laid an egg with their performance against the Houston Texans. But I guess, Payne, we have to give Houston a little bit of credit for all we've picked on them. I know it was the Jags, but they amass almost 500 yards on less than 60 plays, average more than 8.5 yards per play. Now, it does come at the expense of a Jaguars defense that was down arguably four of its top five players.
Yeah, when you lose Miles Jack and you lose your two starting corners. And more importantly, the way
Josh
Houston
Allen is out too, right?
Yeah, I believe so. More importantly, the way you went about this prior week, right? Everyone thought the, you know, when you look at Houston, right, they basically revolted against the head coach. So they had to come out here, or it would have been proven that, hey, maybe this team just isn't very good. So this was kind of that last-ditch effort here from Houston. They did take advantage of a beat-up Jacksonville defense. But it was good to get Deshaun Watson going, right? You know, 10.2 yards per pass attempt, a 63% success rate through the air. He had six explosives and three touchdowns. He's still turning the ball over a little bit too much. Needs to get that figured out. Not quite sure what Tim Kelly is, the OC. So it'll be interesting to see what those game plans look like moving forward. Not completely in love with him, but something to monitor. And this, I guess, was a good stepping stone for the Texans offense.
Before we fully transition from the good to the bad, one game in particular stands out, and want to get your take on if it was one team being particularly good or their opponents struggling a decent amount, and that, of course, was the Browns-Colts performance. We saw the Browns take money throughout the course of the week, ultimately close a short favorite. John Sheeran on Thursday's podcast kind of indicated that might be the case. They go out there, they get a big win, move to 4-1 on the season. But for me, Payne, I watched that Indianapolis Colts team. We thought the defense wasn't as good as advertised, but that wasn't the problem. That offense still seems to be struggling to find an identity, and I was reluctant to sign into Phillip Rivers being old, but man, did a lot of those throws from the pocket really feel labored and forced.
Yeah, maybe. you know, I think a lot of it has to do with what we're seeing in terms of their offensive identity. They don't know what they want to be quite yet. The ground game hasn't been as efficient as projected when you have that caliber of offensive line. Anthony Costanzo missed the game at left tackle. There was a wild metric out there. I wouldn't even call it a metric, but a trend. I think the Colts now move to 1-10 in games Anthony Costanzo misses. So clearly a vital part there. But in terms of the offense, we're still getting a lot of predictability from Frank Reich. I mean, I didn't watch the game in full, but when I was peeking at it, just a load of second and long runs again. Weren't overly aggressive early on in the game, although it was a little better than last week in terms of aggressiveness. But we're looking at the weapons, right? Like, I know it's easy to point the finger at Phillip Rivers here, but like, T.Y. Hilton looks like a shell of himself. And we're looking at Paris Campbell and Michael Pittman Jr., two young guys who you drafted early on in back-to-back drafts, are not out there. So the offense just isn't what we expected it to be, with the offensive line not playing up to their potential and just the weapons outside being, at this point, abysmal. And that was kind of the one thing we discussed multiple weeks ago. The question mark that I had about the offense was the weapons. And right now, we just need to see what this looks like when they start to get a little bit healthier. But clearly a big game this week. You're favored by 8.5. You got to go out there and get a win. And I think if you're the Colts organization, if you could start 4-2 after throwing up on yourself week one against Jacksonville, I think you're probably content with that.
I can't argue that particular assessment at all, and we'll see if they can get healthier in that receiving core. To give Phillip Rivers a couple of additional weapons if Paris Campbell's able to return sooner rather than later. I don't even know what to call what I saw take place in the nation's capital with Washington from an offensive standpoint. Of course, Dwayne Haskins gets benched in favor of Kyle Allen, but you can't put all the blame and responsibility on Haskins. They pick up 108 total yards in that football game, average a shade more than 2 yards per play. 73 yards of their total offensive output come on their lone touchdown drive in the first quarter. 7 second half drives, didn't have a single first down, 19 plays. They gained a grand total of -6 yards. Now, I don't want to bury the lead. Alex Smith back out there on a football field, something we didn't think we were potentially ever going to see. But offensively, I mean, this Washington team is an absolute mess.
Yes. Probably one I'm not going to dive into too far, because the main story is Alex Smith is back, and no one thought that that was a possibility, you know, almost 2 years ago. So I don't really want to crush him. And that's basically, yeah, he doesn't look comfortable out there. So we'll have to figure out what that looks like this week, but didn't really expect much from Alex Smith in his first go around. Glad to see him out there. They pan to his wife and kids, as the media and all these networks try to do, create the storyline and drama. So you're watching his wife there as he's out in the field getting sacked a quadrillion times, like just holding their breath. So, I mean, at this point, like, I don't really want to crap on the Redskins' offensive performance. It was just good to see Alex Smith back out there.
No, for sure. You definitely hope that he feels more and more comfortable in the pocket, but you do wonder where along the lines of going, all right, enough is enough already. You've endured a heck of a lot at the position, but ultimately that falls on Alex Smith, his family, and the rest of the Washington football team's organization. From a bad standpoint, I know we gave credit to the Dolphins, but how much of that responsibility for what we saw unfold in Santa Clara falls on the 49ers, both on the offensive and defensive side?
Yeah, right now their defense is just beaten and battered. You know, we know about the guys they lost along the defensive line, but they're also decimated in the secondary. So you're not quite sure when some of those guys are going to return in the back half. And that's really impacted things. Kyle Shanahan was caught between a rock and a hard place offensively. This felt like a good matchup when you look at how the Dolphins stop the run, when you look at how they cover cover tight ends and running backs. The motion and play action usually has been the Achilles heel of the Dolphins defense, but the offense got out to that early lead, which was crucial. And it forced the 49ers to kind of come out of that running shell. I mean, if you look at Mostert, guy had like 90 yards. He was averaging like almost 9 yards a carry. You just couldn't get him the ball. The problem is at quarterback. So, you know, you bring back Jimmy G, who's less than 100%, and you have to do that because you don't believe in C.J. Beathard, but you benched Nick Mullins on the final drive Sunday night. So Kyle Shanahan got himself caught in a web there. And so clearly Jimmy G not 100%. And I know everyone who doesn't like Jimmy G took to social media and said, got benched. Technically, yes. But Kyle Shanahan came out immediately and said, hey, listen, we're trying to protect Jimmy G. That's why he's not back out there. So that's kind of created some question marks for the game this coming weekend, is who's going to be the quarterback. Is Jimmy G going to be healthy enough to play? If not, can you go back to Nick Mullins, who you benched for C.J. Beathard? So Kyle Shanahan right now is in a little bit of a conundrum at the quarterback spot.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch the first quarter, as I said. I watched the second. Jimmy clearly not comfortable in that ankle. There was very little zip, and every throw he made downfield felt like it was airmailed. So be interesting to see how much healthier he can get with a few more days, because they do have a massive divisional game, as you mentioned, and we'll talk about that in some of our look-ahead lines. Anything else particularly?
You could just see he couldn't plant.
Yeah,
right? He couldn't
exactly
drive off the ankle. Everything was floating high. He was inaccurate. It was, you know, listen, I probably give him a run at a game like that because it's so important to get the win when you look at the schedule moving forward. It's probably not one that C.J. Beathard could win you, candidly speaking. I think you have to go back to Nick Mullins and kind of just chalk up that Sunday night against Philadelphia as, hey, listen, this was just a bad performance. It was a really bad performance. But you've had both C.J. Beathard and Nick Mullins in your system for multiple years now. There's a reason why Nick Mullins you went with in these situations for the last couple of years.
So
you got to kind of chalk up Sunday night and I think get back to Nick Mullins.
You have to know what you have, and you can't just make a knee-jerk reaction based on a three-quarter sample size of when one player floundered a little bit. So let's see what direction the 49ers ultimately elect to go in for that Sunday Night Football game against the Rams. Anything else, Payne, that stood out to you that was particularly bad so far through NFL Week 5?
Zach Taylor kicking a field goal at the end there. I don't know what that was. It was 27-0. You had a 4th-and-7 right around the red zone. And Zach Taylor's like, you know, let's just pop one through the uprights for 3 for appearance's sake. I just, some of that stuff I don't get. Now, Joe Burrow wasn't very good here. And it almost felt like Baltimore put that game on themselves defensively leading up to the week, knowing that their quarterback, Lamar Jackson, wasn't 100%. Some serious sharp money there on Cincinnati. And I know the narrative this morning is, I'm kind of going through social media, is Joe Burrow, small hands, weather got to him. I'm like, did we not watch last week when it was a downpour in Cincinnati and just shredded through Jacksonville's defense in the second half? So you'll hear some narrative stuff about Joe Burrow and his small hands and how the weather impacted the performance. I don't think that was quite it. But just an ugly performance from Zach Taylor and the Bengals offense. 205 total yards, 3.2 yards per play, and a 29% success rate. That isn't going to get it done.
And the craziest part about that football game, unfortunately, I forced myself to actually watch it. The Bengals had multiple chances. Well, multiple is relatively speaking. They had chances early in the game, unable to convert a 4th down, even at 20-0. Baltimore seemed intent just to get out of Dodge. We knew Lamar Jackson wasn't anywhere close to 100%. I don't even know what his final rushing tally looked like. But that just looked like a workmanlike performance. And to the Ravens' defensive credit, they went out there, made enough plays, and the Bengals were unable to execute in any capacity.
No, they couldn't do anything, even through the air. I mean, 3.6 yards per pass attempt for the Bengals' offense just isn't going to get it done in 2020, especially when you're attempting to play catch-up and you spot them a 17-0 lead prior to the half. There was, you know, the other thing defensively there, it felt like Cincinnati was doing some things as I watched that game early on 1st and 2nd down. They just couldn't get off the field on 3rd down. And that had been something where the secondary had kind of been playing above expectations, even with a couple guys beaten and battered there and injured in the back half of that defense. Cincinnati's pass defense was actually pretty decent. And I think that was part of the handicap. We're saying to ourselves, hey, if Lamar is dinged up and the knee injury, regardless of, you know, it being played down, he did miss 2 days of practice, something he hadn't done in his entire career, missed consecutive days of practice. So it was something. If we can get a Baltimore offense that doesn't feature Lamar as a runner, we feel pretty good about where our secondary is right now. And they just couldn't get off the field on a lot of that, a lot of those 3rd and longs in the first half.
Yeah, the Bengals had absolutely no answer for those intermediate down conversions for Mark Andrews specifically. Just couldn't cover the tight end. And you saw Lamar go to his security blanket over and over again. Hollywood Brown had a couple nice plays. Ultimately, Baltimore goes out, completes the workmanlike effort, wins 27-3. Apparently, as you mentioned, Zach Taylor thought they were 24.5-point underdogs, and he was covering for his boosters as head coach in Nebraska against Oklahoma. For those folks who want to look it up, go check it out. You can find that lovely game that ended 30-3 with Nebraska as a 27.5-point dog, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago. as they look to just cover the number. As far as Ugly was concerned, we had a pair of broken ankles, one going to get a lot more headlines, but one we saw on Thursday night I think will be equally impactful for a team that saw themselves and still very much does as contenders in the NFC. So we can start with the Dak broken ankle pain. You hate to see a quarterback playing under a franchise tag, given everything that Dak has done there, the fact that he's taken some of the franchise discounts, have that ankle injury, but all reports, at least through his surgery this morning, seem to be pretty optimistic that it'll be about a 4 to 6 month recovery for him.
Yeah, fingers crossed that it's only 4 to 6 months and that there's no nerve damage there. And if not, he'll be back and he'll persevere. And I think it's just a tough situation, right? If you're following the Dak saga, so to speak, and in the timeline of things that have gone on recently in his life with, you know, his mother passing and his brother taking his life and, you know, being a huge proponent of mental health, discussing openly about his depression and on World Mental Health Day, that happening to him. It just, you start to wonder how things like that can potentially go awry. So hopefully he's back and healthy. You're going to hear a lot of people saying that this is why you take the guaranteed money. Candidly speaking, he's making 31.4 million this year, I believe it is. I think he made the right decision. I can even say that now wholeheartedly, even after the injury, because we saw what Deshaun Watson signed for. And the offer on the table from Dallas is about 60 million less than what Deshaun Watson signed for. So he knew what the market was. This is just a piss poor break. And I think he'll bounce back. He'll be fine. And he'll sign a bigger deal than what was offered to him initially.
Yep, like you said, I mean, hey, the adversity that's out there, you hope there's no lingering effects of that particular gruesome injury, but ultimately Dak, you'd think, has another shot to play and still continue to be the Cowboys franchise quarterback. And so we usher in the Andy Dalton era on Monday night when they'll take on the Arizona Cardinals. The other broken ankle, of course, I'm referring to one of the defensive stalwarts that the casual fan may not know the name, but I think any of us who have handicapped the Tampa Bay Bucks over the last couple of years and have talked at great lengths about how good that run defense has been under Todd Bowles, Vita Vea going down. What do you think that does for Tampa's defensive front going forward, Bane?
Certainly hurts that you can't pair him there alongside Nnamdi Kanu. That is a really, really beefy tandem up there. And the one thing about Vita Vea is, like, when he was drafted, we're like, this guy's just going to be a pure run stuffer. And certainly he's helped Todd Bowles' defense. They've been one of the most efficient stopping the run the last two seasons. But he was able to start, he was dropped a couple pounds, and he was actually providing a decent little surge of pass rush up the middle as well. And that was surprising to a lot of people. When you looked at things like his spark score, like, this guy's just going to be a pure run stuffer. He was really doing a good job, you know, relatively speaking, starting to get some pressure from the interior as well. So that's a big loss to Todd Bowles and the Bucs defense there. Already seeing some over money come in for their matchup against Green Bay this weekend. Not all to do with Vita Vea, but certainly a significant loss on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, some I'm sure has to do with a quarterback who apparently temporarily lost his mind on Thursday night as well. Tom Brady comes out and says, hey, look, I probably should have tried to pick up the first down instead of throwing downfield. We obviously saw social media folks trying to eviscerate Tom for losing a little bit of his head in terms of overall game awareness, but I'm going to kind of give the guy a free pass knowing what he's accomplished. It is definitely unusual, though, when you see one of the sport's brightest stars and obviously the greatest quarterback to ever play the position have a little bit of a brain cramp in that kind of situation.
How do you think his preparation is going to be this week?
Oh, I'm pretty sure he's going to be razor sharp. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I would concur there. I think when you have a guy of that mental fortitude, kind of for the first time, you know, losing his mind there a little bit, you know, not, it's one thing to have an error of the physical sense, but the mental sense, that's something that we've kind of always praised Tom Brady for. He's always been that the head coach on the field. And that was shocking to see. And it happens in a national spotlight and everyone's breaking his balls, you know, for the next week or so. I would think that he's going to have a very, very good week of practice.
Speaking of which, and of course, I have a couple TVs going in my office, and one of the more prominent morning shows, their leading headline, are the Chiefs too dependent on Patrick Mahomes? Payne, I know the world has officially lost its damn mind. You have the best quarterback in the position, and he loses a game to the Raiders, and suddenly the Chiefs are somehow too dependent on their star quarterback, the face of the NFL. Did anybody ever say that about Tom Brady when he was winning Super Bowl after Super Bowl in New England?
I think in 2020 you're praying that and you can be dependent on your quarterback.
Oh my God. Oh, anything people will do for that's hot rough. Takes on a Monday morning, let's put it that way. But the good, the bad, and the ugly, a little bit more extensive than usual. I think that we uncovered a lot of good stuff and hopefully some tidbits that'll help our listeners become better handicappers and not overreact or in some cases underreact to what they plan to do for the week 6 numbers, which we'll get to in a second. But of course, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. And also follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And Payne, when we look at some of the look-ahead numbers, we'll run through them real quick. We now see the Lions more than a field goal favorite coming out of the bye on the road at Jacksonville. The look-ahead price had them as just a modest 2.5-point favorite.
Yeah, you get Detroit off the bye, and hopefully...
Yeah, Matt Patricia with extra time to prepare. What could go wrong?
Yeah, hopefully, you know, you get a little healthier in the secondary. Hopefully, you can devise a game plan that at least slows down Gardner Minshew. I think Jacksonville probably is reverting back to the team we thought they potentially were. And as we talked at the top, a slew of injuries on the defense that we'll have to monitor with Miles Jack and Allen and two starting corners. The other situation here is DJ Chark left the Houston game late with an ankle injury as well. So, partly the bye, partly Jacksonville being downgraded, and then the injury situation there to a lot of key cogs on the Jaguars team.
We mentioned the battle for the Bay, a game that, of course, we'll preview in great detail on Thursday. We have seen the favorite flip in this particular matchup. The look-ahead number had Tampa, a 2.5-point home favorite at FanDuel. Now you're looking at Green Bay, a 1.5-point favorite on the surface, a 4-point move. But as we know, not through any key numbers and probably has more impact on the way you'll handle the teaser assessment on this game than anything else.
Yeah, exactly. Move through zero. Not the most significant, but it certainly does open up the teaser window in a different direction there. Tampa Bay losing, obviously, on Thursday night and from a national audience changes some perception a little bit. Green Bay gets the bye. I think at this point it's safe to say Devontae Adams will be out there. And just the way the Packers have looked, again, dominating on Monday night in front of a national audience. So that's partly what this is, right? National games to different outcomes, and then partly in the anticipation of Devontae Adams returning. That's partly what this line move is.
The biggest line move of the week will be in prime time, where we see the favorite move, and it's from one key number completely the other direction through a key number. The Los Angeles Rams, now a 3.5-point road favorite at San Francisco coming into this past weekend. We were looking at San Francisco opening a 3-point favorite at FanDuel.
Yeah, so you're off back-to-back losses as more than touchdown favorites in both games. So the perception, and I think the reality of San Francisco right now is dramatically different. There's a slew of injuries, as I kind of alluded to at the top there, along both the defensive lines and secondary for the 49ers. They can't cover right now. And then there's question marks at quarterback. Jimmy G, again, clearly not healthy yesterday. Couldn't step into throws or drive the ball with his plant ankle. That was sprained, you know, again. Kyle didn't bench him for performance. He did it to protect him. So let's see if he's going to be out there this week. You know, not quite sure. If he didn't re-aggravate it, then there could be a possibility that he's out there after, you know, another week. And then the question mark is, if it's not Jimmy G, then who? You know, is it Nick Mullins? Do you go back to him? Or is it Beathard?
Joe Montana.
Steve Young. That would be the hope, I think. I think that would be the hope. So I think that's what we're looking at here. And then the Rams, man. Just the situation yesterday. Now, I know that there was situation built into that line. The number certainly wouldn't indicate that line should have been 7. We made it a little bit higher, but the spot was just ridiculous for the Rams. I mean, 3 true East Coast trips this season so far. They handled it. And so I think that's partly it. There's a little bit more buy-in, I think, from both odds makers and bettors on the Rams so far this season. And we kind of talked about, I think, in the offseason that the 49ers might be a little bit of a sell team early on in the season. And we're seeing those two things unfold. And then the injuries to the 49ers, you know, in addition to those two kind of teams changing perceptions, the injuries are just a lot to overcome right now for the 49ers.
And last but not least, again, we'll preview a week from today right here on the Bet the Board podcast. Of course, the Arizona Cardinals will go into Dallas, a game where Dallas was listed as a field goal favorite at FanDuel. Of course, the injury to Dak Prescott drastically changes this particular handicap. Arizona beats the much maligned Jets, and suddenly we're looking at the Arizona Cardinals, now a field goal road favorite.
Yeah, it's a 6.5-point swing, huh? Through both threes.
We can leave it at that if you want, buddy. We can leave it at that.
Yeah. Interesting. So, you know, you brought in Andy Dalton for a reason, right? Like, he is he's a veteran. And candidly, we got the intensity from Dallas's defense. That final score was one of the most misleading of the entire weekend. A lot of professional bettors buried that under from 54 down to 51.5.
And I don't want to talk about it.
You probably got the right pace and the right style of play. The problem is the wrong team got out ahead. Because we've kind of saw in week one, right, against the Rams, that Dallas, if they were in the ball game, if it was close, they were going to run the ball. And when you have a team that, regardless of if sharp money came against them or not, they're more than a touchdown favorite, so it would indicate that they're going to be playing with the lead. They'd get going with the run, but the Giants got out ahead, two defensive touchdowns. But if you look, you know, at the defense, really the Giants had four drives of 39 yards or more. One of them ended in a touchdown. That was it. You got the defensive score. You got the turnover that led to a short field. So Dallas's defense showed more intensity, showed more effort as well.
Yeah, the Giants' inability or lack thereof to drive the football won't have anybody comparing them to what we saw in the college football ranks with Alabama, who picked up about 97% of the available offensive yards on Saturday in their game against Ole Miss. So, interesting contest. We'll see how the Cowboys can handle it. Clearly a big challenge for them going forward, but a division that'll open up all sorts of opportunity, knowing that Washington, New York aren't breathing down their neck, and by the looks of things, Philadelphia not exactly looking at all like a playoff contender, with Travis Fulgham becoming their leading wide receiver, although for extended stretches yesterday did look a lot like Julio Jones, tormenting the Pittsburgh Steelers defense. But alas, Payne, those are the look-ahead numbers.
Matt Patricia brilliant decision there.
I mean, there's a number of them. Ultimately, when Matt Patricia is looking for his next coaching job, I mean, someone in Detroit, an intrepid beat writer, is going to put together a top 10 list of everything that he accomplished or didn't. And I think we're, you know, all going to be able to laugh at it.
Yeah. I didn't realize I was poking around yesterday with some DFS stuff after the big catch Sunday night against San Francisco. They propelled, and I say they, Philadelphia, Doug Peterson, propelled Fulgham into a larger role. And I think, what did he end up with, 10 catches?
Oh, 10 catches.
153 and a touchdown.
Yep, I was going to say. All right, on to tonight's campaign, where we have a game that has a little bit of intrigue. We'll see how the New Orleans Saints handle Prosperity as they'll play host to the Los Angeles Chargers, a game last week that we thought could potentially be moved to Indianapolis in the wake of Hurricane Delta. We're looking at New Orleans now, a 6.5-point favorite at FanDuel. Total on this game sits at 49.5. And when you look at the Chargers over their last 20 games on the road, I mean, this is a team that's been battle-tested, 12-8 straight up, 12-6-2 against the spread. So far this season, every Chargers game has been decided by 7 or less. They're 1-3 on the season, but a point differential of only minus 12. And the Saints, no stranger to off-field drama, decided to give us a great little nugget this week as their top offensive playmaker not going to be available, and it has nothing to do with the high ankle sprain, but suspended for conduct detrimental to the team, decided to punch teammate C.J. Gardner-Johnson in the eye during practice, the first time since 2017 that the Saints have a team-imposed suspension, that, of course, being P.J. Williams back in the day. Payne, when we look at this particular matchup, it's Justin Herbert going into hostile territory, albeit not with a New Orleans Saints crowd foaming at the mouth. We saw Kirk Cousins perform better than he had in the past on the road in Seattle without that crowd. What do we make of this Chargers offense matched up with the Saints defense?
So, first of all, how do we think this fight unfolded?
I'm going to go with it's not a Golden Tate, Jalen Ramsey type story, but who knows? Maybe I'm wrong.
That's actually pretty funny.
Do we think it involves someone with the name of Precious Cinnamon or Ginger? Do we think that's what prompted the fight?
no, my guess is kind of knowing Gardner, he's kind of a dog. My feeling is, I mean that in a good sense, the football sense. My feeling is he was, you used the Jalen Ramsey thing, and so I just kind of wanted to clarify. Like he's a little bit of a feisty guy on the field. And so I could see a situation where Michael Thomas, coming back from injury, probably didn't like the physicality in a practice. So that would be my guess on how things unfolded. Speculating there. Don't have any information, but possibly, if I were a betting man, that's kind of how that unfolded. So massive loss there for sure. But I was kind of leaning on you. I didn't know if you had heard anything there.
No. I hadn't heard any additional details. And it's always one of those things that really leaves you scratching your head when it's a superstar that's suspended that had to be pretty bad for it not to be the secondary player that has the team impose suspension. And you wonder how healthy Thomas really was, as you indicated. And if the Saints use this, come, hey, you know what? All right, Michael, we're going to keep you out for another game as much for precautionary reasons as anything else. Because you have to think, if this was late in the year and this was for a division title on the line and they were playing the Tampa Bay Bucks, Sean Payton and the rest of his coaching staff might find a way to overlook it. Having lived through this kind of situation, albeit at a much, much, much lesser level, the superstar typically gets his way in these kind of instances.
Yeah, I would think so. That's kind of my feeling. He potentially overreacted to being treated a little bit more physically in practice as he's, you know, working himself back from an injury. That would be my guess on how this unfolded. And then obviously Gardner can just kind of view, hey, this was within the realm of play. This is just football on his end, and that's why he's potentially out there. But this is going to be the lead up to the entire evening, which is going to be terrible.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get this as the storyline, and you wonder for a team last weekend who maybe found a little bit of its swagger on the offensive side with 5 touchdowns in 5 drives, if players like Emmanuel Sanders and Tre'Quan Smith can continue to raise your level of play. And we talk about this all the time, Payne, and I think week to week the fan obviously gets pissed off with it. But when you're playing games without your best player, knowing it's not a season-ending injury, this may not show up on the stat sheet weeks 3 through 5, but you can damn well bet your better dollar. It makes for a more explosive, more dynamic offense when the games matter most, weeks 15 through 17 and on through the postseason.
Yeah, without question. And listen, we can kind of, you know, venture off into what this means for the Saints offense. And you know, without Michael Thomas involved, I think it changes everything dramatically. You know, he's one of the few skill guys, and I'm pretty confident in saying this, and I don't say this lightly, and I don't throw around numbers like this, but he is at least a full point to this spread. I would even venture he's worth 1.5 points to this offense. And when you look at Drew Brees, and I don't want to call it, you know, a pea shooter of an arm, but he has lost some velocity. No, it's not. He has lost some velocity, right? But it doesn't mean that he's a poor quarterback. He's still a fantastic quarterback. But the point is, he is more of a anticipation thrower right now because he doesn't trust the arm as much. So it's all about preparation for Drew Brees. It's all about knowing where guys are going to be so he can throw it to the spot long before most quarterbacks do. So when you don't have a Michael Thomas, who you know is going to be exactly where you want him to be, and you anticipate the throw, some of these other guys he hasn't quite been as entrusting in. Now he's starting to get there with Emmanuel Sanders. We saw that anticipatory throw before the half against Green Bay, and that kind of changed some things a little bit. And then you rattle off 35 unanswered against Detroit. So he's starting to get there a little bit. But that's kind of what you're losing with Michael Thomas in this offense. Now, the positive here is Drew Brees got to see the ball go through the hoop, so to speak, last week against Detroit's defense. He was starting to throw with anticipation, and he did a good job trusting some of those guys to be in the right spots. And I get it, it's the Lions secondary. But, you know, you go out there and you do what you're supposed to do. 61% passing success rate, 8.4 yards per pass attempt, 3 explosives the final 3 quarters. And you're down 14-0. It would be easy in my mind, right, to kind of tense up after playing the way Brees has prior to that point. So hopefully you know, the first three quarters, or the final three quarters, rather, last week, build some of that confidence back. And I think when you're looking at how you want to attack this Chargers defense, it seems pretty easy. You know, when you're looking at Drew Brees and, you know, you're going to, I guess, have this balanced attack tonight, you want to run from three wide receiver sets and throw from two tight end sets, because that's where the advantages lie. And if you look at kind of their breakdown offensively, New Orleans runs the ball 35% of the time from three wide sets, which is, you're not going to have as many blockers out there, but you're not going to be as predictable either. So when you look, Alvin Kamara and the other backs have been pretty good. They've in totality, successful in 55% of runs from three wide sets. Chargers defense, they've given up 5.4 yards per rush against runs from 11. When Brees does throw, again, and we always talk about this, but it seems pretty apparent and teams don't do it enough, but you want to throw from heavier sets. The Saints have been absolutely dominant when they throw from two tight end sets. Now, we're going to have to monitor the Jared Cook situation. Missed last week, was limited in practice all this week. So it'd be huge to get him back tonight. So you do have to kind of pay attention leading up to kickoff there. But if he's back, monstrous, because you're looking right now, teams that have thrown against the Chargers defense from two tight end sets, 76% success rate, 158 passer rating. They've averaged nearly 13 yards per pass attempt with three touchdowns and no picks. So you're going to want to watch for that tonight. If Jared Cook is back, do the Saints throw the ball from two tight end sets? The other reason there you'd want to throw from 12 based upon this matchup is the Chargers haven't recorded a single sack against two tight end sets. And that's telling, because right now, if you look, and this stunned me as I broke this game down a little bit, Chargers are sixth in pressure rate. Gus Bradley's done that by only sending 10% blitzes. And that's wild when you consider, right? They've been without Melvin Ingram for a few games, Joey Bosa, less than 100%. So it's pretty key here. If you throw from 12, you're probably going to have a better chance protecting Brees as well, who hasn't been good under pressure there. 79 passer rating under pressure. So that's the key tonight. One, you're watching this game. If the Saints are in three wide sets, let's see him hand the ball off to Alvin Kamara. See how successful that is. When they're throwing the ball, if you can play with a lead, you know, you can get in your two tight end sets if Jared Cook is healthy, and how they perform throwing from those heavy formations. They should fare pretty well here against this Chargers defense.
Yeah, and a pretty shared workload in terms of the Saints running backs last week. We saw Kamara carry it 19 times for 80 plus, Latavius Murray 14 carries, 64 yards, and a pair of touchdowns himself. Obviously, when they were playing with a lead, there's no reason to go out there and pound Kamara into the ground. So keep that in mind as you look to handicap some of those particular prop markets. If you believe it'll be a one-score game, you have to imagine it's a lot more Kamara than it is Latavius Murray. But to Sean Payton's credit, he has tried to lighten the workload, knowing that Kamara remains their most dynamic playmaker, especially with Michael Thomas shelved. You mentioned that Chargers defense, and of course, I don't want to pin all the responsibility for them blowing a 17-point lead on the stop unit. Not quite sure what the Chargers were doing offensively. With a 24-7 lead, you give up a costly fumble before the half, and a single play probably shifted that game more than any other throughout the course of Week 4, with Ndamukong Suh getting his big paw on it. But Justin Herbert, at least through two games, has been pretty decent for a rookie quarterback. We know that the ground attack will be without Austin Eckler, of course, who was placed on IR, going to be led by Joshua Kelly. We'll see Justin Jackson in the backup role. Last week, the Chargers weren't able to get that ground game going. Herbert took things over, threw for 290 yards, three touchdowns, and a pretty impressive quarterback rating to boot. This Saints defense, Payne, has really struggled to slow down opposing passers, and they're still dealing with some injuries on the defensive side of the ball.
I think Justin Herbert's playing really well. He's playing confidently, too. So it's not a surprise that Anthony Lynn smartly named him the starting quarterback. And I was reading an article the other day that Lynn kind of playfully took a jab at the media and said, I had to name Herbert the quarterback so you guys would stop asking me about it multiple times a day.
Poor Tyrod Taylor, by the way. Losing his starting job with a punctured lung because Herbert's played so well.
Yes. I think it was inevitable. I had heard that Herbert had just been killing it through camp. And if you're going to do that in this type of environment with a shortened offseason, it was only a matter of time. Tyrod didn't look very good against the Bengals. You know, if he'd went out there and looked like a million bucks, this decision would have been significantly tougher. But you're right. I mean, getting basically a punctured lung via the medical staff and then losing your job, it's certainly a tough break. I think the decision was a no-brainer, though. And if you start to dig into this a little bit, in the games that Herbert has started, the Chargers are above average in overall success rate. Coming into this week with Justin Herbert as the quarterback, the Chargers were top 10 in explosive passing. And of all the qualifying quarterbacks, Justin Herbert only trails Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, and Derek Carr in completion percentage above expectation. And I think the kicker here is when you start to look at the defenses Herbert's played, he's done this against two top five defenses in efficiency in both KC and Tampa. And then you're looking, and well, you know, the Saints defense hasn't played up to its normal standard. And Dennis Allen does some complex things that potentially in an offseason that we've had is the reason why we've seen some of these communication breakdowns and the Saints defense not playing to a level that at least visually appears to be what we expect of them. Now, again, if you just look at the efficiency metrics, New Orleans is top 10 defense right now. But there are some holes there. It's just a matter of Herbert taking advantage. Obviously, a huge break for the Chargers. Tonight, you kind of hinted at this with not having fans there. The mayor of New Orleans rejected the request for 25% fan capacity this week. Instead of 19,000 fans, it's just 750 family members and friends allowed at the game. So another element there that Herbert doesn't have to battle. That should absolutely help. The key to this game is going to be pressure. You know, with Brian Bulaga and Trey Turner out, so you have two of the starting five linemen for the Chargers down, both key acquisitions this offseason. So if you're looking right now, what's more impressive also about Herbert is of the quarterbacks this season with 100 dropbacks, Justin Herbert's been pressured at the second highest rate, 41%, and he's still performing admirably here. Unfortunately, you know, if you're looking at the Saints, they haven't generated the kind of pressure that we've seen in recent seasons, below average in both pass rush win rate and pressure rate. It sounds simple. I get it. You know, it's like, hey, just get pressure on the quarterback. But when you look at where the, you know, when you start to like gauge where these injuries are, if you can make Justin Herbert uncomfortable, it's key, because if you can pressure Herbert with the two starting linemen down, he's without his safety valve, which you mentioned in Austin Eckler, one of the best pass catching backs in the league. But if Herbert has time to throw, you're looking at a Saints secondary that's going to be without starting corner Janaris Jenkins. Marshawn Lattimore and Malcolm Jenkins both missed last week. They've only put up limited practices this week. So two more guys that we're going to have to monitor here before the 8:15 kickoff. That will be crucial to potentially deciding this game. The other thing here is, you know, without Eckler, I think you really want to, and if you're forced to get the ball out quickly because the pressure is too much, you really got to start looking to Hunter Henry. I think he plays a huge role tonight. And if you're looking through four games, Saints have allowed nearly 10.5 yards per reception to tight ends. The Saints are bottom five in the league in both receptions and yards allowed to tight ends. Saints have given up a league high five touchdowns to the tight end position. So, you know, tonight I think you want to potentially get the ball out quick if the pressure's too much. Target the big guy over the middle, get the ball out quickly. I think that'll help Justin Herbert. But, you know, I'm not saying anything here that's shocking. And I think a lot of our listeners will be like, do the sharp guys just take dog and under every game? I don't know, but I can tell you that's what's happened this evening, right? You're looking at this line from 7.5 down to 6.5. Even saw this one group last night take the 7 on the Chargers. And the under's been coming in since the beginning of the week at 52.5. Now, obviously, you know, you put yourself in good positions, and sometimes when you do that, you get a little lucky, and that happened with Michael Thomas going out. So, you know, they didn't have a crystal ball there and, you know, knew that Michael Thomas would lose his mind in practice, but they put themselves in a good position. And so those were the two moves, so to speak, on this game, dog and under. We'll see if it comes to fruition.
Yeah, you mentioned a point, though, that I want to bring up, and I wasn't sure if we were going to talking about it, because it came from one of our more active listeners asking about professionals and how they look at the NFL markets. And I think it's important to kind of discuss the tendency has always been to gravitate towards unders, towards underdogs. But that, of course, is a game-by-game sample size. It's not. It's an unfair generalization to try and make when you look at these things. And I think a lot of folks go, well, you know what? No matter what, I don't want to bet against Aaron Rodgers. I don't want to bet against Patrick Mahomes. And it hurts that much more when you lose the elite quarterbacks, knowing that betting Tom Brady blindly at home as a member of the Patriots would have been able to build you a beach house if you were betting enough money. But you have to look look at every one of these games as its own individual sample size. The point spread, as we always say, is the great equalizer. And ultimately, if you make a game four and the market offers you 6.5, 7, you have to throw out some of the names that are attached to it and make decisions that are going to put you in the best place to win long term. And Payne, you talked about it at great lengths last year, and I kind of brought it up on social last week. The difference between someone that does this professionally and someone that does this as a loss leading hobby instead of playing golf is essentially 3 games over 100 game sample size. So if you can get the best of the number, you can put a couple extra points in your back pocket. It's ultimately going to pay dividends regardless of if you're betting favorites, underdogs, overs, unders, what have you, across not just the NFL, but every sport in general.
Absolutely. And it's that mental hurdle also. That, you know, you say to yourself, oh my God, I bet against Patrick Mahomes this week or Aaron Rodgers and they beat me. Duh. So you have to be able to get over that mental hurdle. The other part of this with sports betting is knowing that you are going to, the best in the world, strike out 45% of the time. So you have to kind of remain mentally stable there. But doing these things, right, taking the extra point, point and a half, 2 points, in value that are there shows itself over 1,000-game sample size, a 2,000-game sample size. A lot of people just get caught in that moment where, you know, that immediate loss is all that they can kind of grasp. And it's really not the way that you should be looking at this. I mean, when you're talking about a lot of these models and you're backtracking this data, figuring out where some of your edges lie, I mean, you don't start to believe it until you get to that 1,000-game sample size mark. So, you know, listen, there's a lot of things, and this season's a little bit different than others, Todd, right? Like, the market's a little bit different. We're dealing with the COVID environment. We're dealing with, you know, certain elements of totals. I don't want to go too far into the totals, but I saw, like, you're kind of leading me up and winding me up here with some of the stuff. You know, everyone's talking now about the totals.
It's a Monday morning. It can be cathartic. Yeah. Get it off of your chest because it precludes us from talking about the Bills-Titans game that we want to have to discuss anyways.
Yeah. That's right. So, like, you know, everyone's talking about these totals. And so you're either on, like, one end of the spectrum or the other. It's like, you know, you can't bet an under. Can't possibly bet an under here. Or you're saying that, like, you know, I saw these, and again, I don't really like to talk too much about this, but, you know, there was a report published, and there's been multiple reports published about why the scoring has increased, and it's like, you know, it's holding. No one's going holding. Sure, there has been a mandate sent down from the league, and they haven't hidden it, that they were unsure if games would be sloppy early on this season, so they didn't want it to become a flag fest in addition to the sloppiness. So they told the refs to kind of hold the whistle a little bit here. Now, if you actually look at the data, like, the increase in holding has been less than a full hold per game. Like, that is not going to drive up scoring 5.5 full points per game. So, you know, people kind of ran to Twitter with this, and rather than, like, hold that information and turn it into, like, 5 and 6 figure bets, we needed 500 and 600 retweets instead. the reality of the situation is a lot of the scoring uptick was coming from just a handful of teams. And those handful of teams are the ones that we've discussed being smarter about throwing earlier and more often, right? Teams like Buffalo, teams like Seattle, teams that have started to integrate analytics and hiring of the right people to get this going on with their offense. And the other ones were, like, simple, right? It's like, you know, they went to veteran quarterbacks like the Miami Dolphins. You know, you think about who their quarterback was last year. They acquired him in the offseason. It was Josh Rosen, learning a brand new system. Well, they got Ryan Fitzpatrick this year operating with Chan Gailey, who is, you know, it's been in his system for 5 years. So kind of comparing, like, literally the increase came from, like, 5 teams. The other thing we've kind of hinted at here is the no home field advantage without the crowd noise. So how do you think these road teams are performing right now going into these stadiums with no crowd noise? That's also kind of been the main key for the scoring increase, right? Not having to go to a silent count. So now your offensive line can get off the ball all at the same time. You know, being able to use a hard count so the defensive line can't actually get to you as quickly. Being able to draw guys off sides. Those are the bigger things than the holding. Not to mention everyone's been more aggressive. right? Teams are going for it more on fourth down. It's led to scores. We saw yesterday where it looked like, I don't want to say the game was starting to teeter a little bit, but you have a defensive-minded coach in Brian Flores on fourth and an inch go for a fake punt. Turns into 7 points on the scoreboard. So we're seeing teams more aggressive on fourth down. We're seeing teams go for it more. We're seeing teams convert at a higher rate. Now, maybe that ticks back a little bit. It's at a ridiculously high rate. Teams are passing more. It's all across the board. The holding is like a minute percentage of it. Very minute. There's my rant.
It's all about the ingredients that go into completing a recipe. It's typically not just one. It's not just two. It's a combination of factors that have changed the NFL. And that's part of the reason that we saw the highest average total in week five that we've ever seen for a week in the National Football League. Meanwhile, you take a glance up and down the odds board this weekend and the highest number out there, at least for what I'm seeing, the 54.5 at FanDuel on Detroit and Jacksonville, a far cry from totals in the mid to high 50s. Ultimately, Payne, we do have one other game that'll take place tomorrow, which would be Tuesday, October 13th. You're looking at Buffalo, a 3-point favorite at FanDuel on the road against a Tennessee Titans team that we know has been besieged by COVID. Total on that game, 53. Don't want to deep dive by any stretch of the imagination, but just the mindset.
No,
in terms
we won't.
No, I know. Just the mindset in terms of handicapping a team that's had such schedule disruptions, more so the Titans than the Bills, obviously, in this game.
So the league is basically, as we have heard other teams and other important people say, listen, Titans should be forfeiting these games. This is on them. We're all adhering to the rules. We're all being safe, sound, and secure. And it's this same team that we've kind of seen not following protocol. This feels like the league is saying, hey, this is your punishment. You yeah, know, because
out,
the Titans
go out there
right
and play
now,
with no prep.
Yeah, go out there and play with no prep. Because if you look, the Titans returned to the practice facility this past Saturday for the first time since September 29th. And then Sunday morning, the staff member tested positive and nobody has been at the facility since. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, it looks like the league saying, hey, we're on here. This is this is going to be a team that's has practiced one time in 2 weeks. This is your punishment. Obviously, you know, we're at 3.5 here. It opened 3. The total probably was going to be appealing to some. I don't know if that will still be the case because we're having an offense, again, that's probably going to be a touch out of rhythm early. But that's it. Like, the line as we're sitting here recording this just kind of fully came up. So I haven't had a chance to fully dig into it. Obviously, I know what our numbers should be, but you know, at the time, it was a difficult game to discuss without a line. And so I kind of need to do a little more digging here before discussing.
No, for sure. Just wanted to, as we see that number pop early on a Monday morning, wanted to throw that out there for our listeners who may be tuning in on their lunch breaks or not having a chance to keep their odds screen up at their desk, although we do strongly encourage you to do that to make sure you're more informed better. It's not most likely the best in business environment policy. But either way, two games still to go in NFL Week 5. Of course, the Chargers-Saints showdown tonight on Monday and a meeting between two undefeated teams in the Bills and Titans taking place on Tuesday. Payne, before we close up shop on this Monday morning, any final words of wisdom, parting shots, observations, things that you just like to get off your chest?
No, that's it. Hopefully right. We got a good game tonight. It's competitive, and we're going to get this thing back on the track here.
There is no doubt about it. It is just a minor blip on the radar, a temporary derailment for the freight train that we know are our best bets and best investments. So for all of us here at the lovely Bet the Board podcast, best of luck with all of your wagers, not only on Saints Chargers tonight, but also should you choose to dabble, which we know you will, in Bills Titans tomorrow. And hopefully come Tuesday evening, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.